Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this CFCA webinar, Evidence, Evidence-Based Programs and Evaluation. My name is Shani Moore, and I'm a research fellow here at the Australian Institute of Family Studies. Today's webinar is intended for Communities for Children facilitating partners, community partners, and others who are implementing the 30% evidence-based program requirement. This webinar is an adaptation of a presentation given to the FRSA Senior Executives Forum in March 2015, and will cover topics such as how evidence is defined and used in this context, the criteria for the evidence-based program profiles and the assessment of other programs, choosing the right program, and information about program planning, implementation and evaluation. Before I introduce our speaker, I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we are meeting today. In Melbourne, the traditional custodians are the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders past and present, and to the elders from other communities who may be participating today. It is now my great pleasure to introduce today's presenter, Ellie Robinson. Ellie is the manager of the Child Family Community Australia, or CFCA, Information Exchange, and the expert panel project here at the Australian Institute of Family Studies. Ellie has extensive experience in knowledge translation and exchange, project management and resource development, and has authored a number of publications and resources. She recently completed her Master of Public Health at the University of Melbourne and also holds postgraduate qualifications in secondary education and adolescent health. Now, I need you to alert you to some brief housekeeping details before I hand over to Ellie. One of the core functions of the CFCA Information Exchange is to share knowledge. So I would like to remind everyone that you can submit questions via the chat box at any time during the webinar. There will be a limited amount of time for questions at the end of Ellie's presentation, and we will try to respond to as many questions as possible. We also want you to continue the conversation we begin here today. To facilitate this, we will set up a forum on the CFCA website where you can discuss the ideas and issues raised and share your own experiences. We will send you a link to the forum later this afternoon. Please remember that this webinar is being recorded and the audio, transcript and presentation slides will be made available on the CFCA website in due course. So please join me with giving Ellie a very warm virtual welcome.
Thanks, Shani, and thank you everyone for attending today. As Shani mentioned, this presentation is most relevant to Communities for Children facilitating partners and others who are involved in delivering these programs, but I will talk generally about some of the concepts and talk more specifically around the requirements for the 30% evidence-based program profiles. So hopefully it will be interest to you all, so you're aware of that. One of the key questions that often arises in projects such as this is and beyond is what is evidence? And there's no one particular answer to this. On the slide is a list of different things that are often identified as evidence in some form. So the more empirical published research that is often peer-reviewed and conducted in a way that gives it some rigour. It may be locally gathered data, which is particularly relevant to programs such as Communities for Children. There may be a program that's built on relevant theory, and again, this is something that's come up in programs around what theories they're based on in Communities for Children and how those theories are operationalised in the programs that are run. Is expert opinion used? This is often the case with things like policy making. Practitioner wisdom and the place of practitioner wisdom when we're looking at what evidence should be driving program delivery. And that includes your own practice wisdom or others around you and in your workplaces and beyond at conferences and so forth and the way that that information is collected. Then there are the more general ones such as Wikipedia and Google results, which may not have quite the same amount of rigour involved but are surprisingly often used in decision-making around evidence. So we'll talk a bit today about which types of evidence have the most rigour behind them in looking at things like evidence-based programs and practices. This is a way of looking at evidence that Jack Shonkoff, who is a child development expert in the US, looks at. And I think this is relevant when we talk about how we have framed evidence within the Communities for Children expectations. So he has three different areas. The first is established knowledge. So that's the knowledge that's defined by the scientific community against a set of strict criteria. It's what we know, using the term know fairly loosely in this sense. But this probably links the most to the evidence-based program profiles that we've put together, and I'll get to those in a little while. But the evidence-based program profiles are most reflective of the information that we know thanks to the scientific and research community. The second area he talks about are reasonable hypotheses, and that's assertions about what we don't necessarily know yet, but they're based on the established knowledge. And these sorts of areas of evidence is the reasons why we put in place the assessment of other programs for the Communities for Children project. And looking at recognising the fact that there was already much good program delivery going on out there that was based on some areas of established knowledge, and recognising that within the project. Lastly, it's unwarranted assertions, and they're the ones that are generated by anyone that may or may not be distortions of established knowledge, but often are distortions in a way that are not helpful. And these are the ones that shouldn't necessarily guide responsible practice, because we want good practice and programs to be based on something that tells us that there is a clear and rigorous relationship between a number of things. Again, the terms that are used in this area when we talk about how we put evidence into practice and policy are quite broad. In particular, people have probably heard mostly of talk about evidence-based practice or policy, or evidence-informed practice and policy. And I just want to talk a little bit about the definitions of those in a minute. Other terms that we've heard being used are evidence-influenced and evidence-aware, probably a little less so than the other two, but it just shows how the grappling of how and what types of evidence influence programs and policy and practice, what terms are used to indicate that. There's no one definition of evidence in practice that's used. So, as I said, the two main ones are evidence-based and evidence-informed. But it largely also depends on how you want to define evidence. So the idea of evidence-based programs and practice was first used in medicine in the early 1990s. And, of course, medicine gives us a much, I guess, clearer relationship between a treatment and an outcome, in that often it's visible. So something like if a patient breaks their arm and you set it and the outcome is that the arm is healed, it's often a lot easier than working with people. But nevertheless, the idea of programs and practices having to have some sort of rigorous evidence base behind them came from medicine and into social work fairly soon after that. The term evidence-informed is often seen as better conveying that decisions are guided or informed by evidence rather than based solely upon it. But one of the things that is becoming clear is that the idea of whether evidence-based or evidence-informed is used to describe something depends on how we define evidence. So if evidence is narrowly defined as just including empirical evidence that comes from research projects, then evidence-informed is a more inclusive way of saying it's not just that evidence that matters. There are other sources of evidence, such as practitioner wisdom and client needs, that need to be given some consideration. So in a sense, we've called what we do evidence-based practice, and that's the term that we've been using, but it's important to say that that's a very inclusive definition of evidence when we use that, and I'll explain that a little more in the next slide. But one of the questions that came in before the webinar was around what evidence takes precedence. And it's a hard question to answer. In some respects, it depends what you're trying to do. And again, the next slide might help to explain that a little bit. But ultimately, what we're trying to do with this project and with similar projects is to move away from the idea of we know it works because we know it works, and trying to put a little bit more rigor behind that. And I'll talk about that a little bit later as well, a bit further. One of the views of evidence-based practice that nicely encapsulates the different types of evidence that can be used is provided by Aaron Schlonsky and Michelle Ballin in an article from 2011 that I'm happy to pass on if people are interested. But they very clearly state that evidence-based practice is an overview of three different things. It's what we know from research evidence and the best research evidence we have, and that's combined with practitioner expertise and client values and expectations around what they want and what they need, all of those things combine to make evidence-based practice. So in this sense, evidence is not narrowly defined as just being about research evidence, but nicely recognises those other impacts as well. What they say is that the way to look at evidence-based practice is to optimise the combination of these things. So where there is good, strong, rigorous research evidence around what works, we give that greater weight within what we're doing, because clearly in that sense there's been research around that says that this works for this particular target group. If there's not such strong research evidence around what works, but there are strong client preferences for a particular program, then you act accordingly. And in some senses, that's also a recognition of the fact that research evidence doesn't always exist for a lot of things that need to happen in program delivery. So particularly when you're innovating in the case of having new target groups or new client needs or adapting an existing program to suit some of those different scenarios. So in those sorts of senses, then the evidence base hasn't necessarily caught up with what needs to be done. And a good example of that is the areas where, at the moment, online and other technologies are used to deliver programs, because often longitudinal studies are difficult for that because the technological environment changes so quickly. So, again, it might be using the best available information outside of the formal evidence base to decide how to address those needs. This might be a familiar concept to people as well, often within the, particularly within the academic areas, people talk about hierarchies of evidence. And I just want to reflect on this for a little while and what this means for particularly what we're trying to do within the expert panel project more broadly and the Communities for Children program area more specifically. Within the realm of research evidence, there's a common understanding that different types of evidence allow stronger or weaker conclusions to be drawn. At the top of the hierarchy of evidence, most often, is randomised controlled trials. And that's where the randomisation comes from, a random allocation to a control or experimental group of your sample. If there's no bias in that allocation, so if that's happened without any interruption from something that would create some bias, it's more reasonable to conclude that the program made a difference, because you can tell the difference between what's happened within the control group that didn't receive the program and what happened in the experimental group that did. So it's considered a strong research design. One of the issues that comes up often around randomised controlled trials within service environments, and this is also relevant to other designs, so not just around coming down on randomised controlled trials, but there are lots of challenges in doing that within the workplace or within a service environment. You may get dropout of participants, and if that happens at a different rate from the two groups, then the validity of what you're studying and the possible biases that are introduced may influence your results. There might be unexpected differences between your control and environmental and experimental group for various reasons, and that again will influence results. One of the most important reasons why in a service environment randomised controlled trials may not be appropriate is the ethical issues behind it. And what we mean by that is the ethical issues involved in withholding treatment from a control group. So an example of that is if we have a really good program that we know works to eliminate or limit domestic violence in homes, and we say we're going to provide this program and we're not going to give it to one group of families and we are going to give it to another, even though we know it works, there's clearly an ethical issue with the fact that that treatment hasn't been provided to people who are experiencing that issue. So ethical issues are one of the most difficult issues in relation to conducting randomised control trials in a service environment. Often next down on the hierarchy of evidence is what's called quasi-experiments. And that's where, rather than using a control group specifically, it's the use of a naturally occurring comparison group. So that might be participants on a waiting list for a program. So you're offering the program to one group and you're not offering the program yet to participants on a waiting list. So they're a naturally occurring comparison group for your project. It might be that you offer a different intervention or a briefer version of the program to your comparison group, and then you compare the outcomes for both those groups. So it's not randomised and it's not controlled. So in that sense, you can't say that overall definitely say that the program caused the changes, but greater benefits to those who received the program may mean it's effective. And comparison groups are often used within this area and are a good use of something that helps us to understand whether the program worked or not for the participants. Down the hierarchy a little bit is pre and post test. So with pre-test and post-test, so you collect data at the start of the program and you collect data at the end of the program and see whether your sample has improved or not improved or stayed the same by the end of the program. There's no comparison or control group, and that's what makes it difficult to know whether it was the program that caused the changes or not, because there might be other factors for each of those groups that have impacted on the outcomes. So no real conclusions can be drawn because the changes might have happened anyway. And a good example of this is where you might run a program, say, on literacy approaches for young children, but at the same time as you're running your program, the families that aren't in your program are also receiving some sort of other literacy program, and so you can't tell that's the reason why for your group that they receive something outside of the program that has influenced the outcomes for them beyond your program. So sometimes it's difficult to separate out the impacts of the program with other things that are going on around those families. One of the debates is around, is it better than nothing? And again, it depends who you ask. For those who very strictly adhere to the hierarchy of evidence, they would probably say that they're not a strong enough or rigorous enough approach to evaluation to give it much credit. However, it does give us some information on what's going on and in some cases is a reasonable way of testing out whether things are working or not, particularly if there's not a natural comparison group that you can use. So one of the examples we've had so far in the assessment of programs is a program that operated in a classroom in a regional area where there wasn't another group of kids at that age. So they were the only class of that particular age group. And so there wasn't a naturally occurring comparison group unless you left the school, and then you start to introduce different types of biases if your comparison group is too different. So for the purposes of this exercise, we certainly, and I'll get to this, but one of the things that we say is a reasonable indication or a rigorous enough indication that the program is having some effect is pre and post testing. This is some of the problems that happen with hierarchies and why there are some questions around how useful they are within these sorts of projects. It neglects a number of important issues, and one of those may be, for example, that the evaluation or the research is a randomised control trial, but the RCT wasn't particularly well implemented. So by all accounts, it ticks off on that, but in fact, the results have been biased in some way. So we can't just say that RCTs or randomised control trials are the be-all and end-all without understanding that they have rigour associated with them as well. By only looking at RCTs and other comparison groups, we may underrate the value of good observational studies, which are often more appropriate for certain programs that, again, going back to programs where there would be ethical issues if a randomised controlled trial was used, observational studies may be a really good way of gathering information from some of those programs. So we have to give them some credit as well. By only concentrating on the upper levels of the hierarchy, we can lose useful evidence. So one of the backlashes against RCTs in a service environment is to say, well, if we just look at there's been 4,000 evaluations of this particular program, but only 8 of them use an RCT or programs for a particular issue, we might be missing a whole lot of things that happen in those other almost 4,000 programs that are of relevance and of importance to us. So we don't want to lose that. What counts as good enough evidence depends on how we want to use it. And this has been a particularly important driver for us in looking at how we approach the requirement, 30% requirement for the Communities for Children programs. We wanted to create a system that that was realistic for the sector. So that's where the assessment of other programs came into the 30% requirement, as saying we have a set of rigorous enough criteria that we can use to say that a program has enough evidence around it for the time being, and we'll also provide providers with information as to how the program can be improved in terms of rigor. I'll get to that later. And there's different uses for different designs. So, again, RCTs and other designs may not be appropriate for particular target groups or programs. One of the things that's important to consider is what sorts of factors influence whether practitioners are more likely to use research evidence. And there's been some studies done on this sort of thing, and it's important, I guess, from an organisational perspective or implementing these sorts of programs that we look at, well, what's the best ways of getting practitioners to understand and use that research evidence within programs? The literature says that it's most likely to happen if it fits with knowledge that's already been gained via hands-on experience, and that makes sense. If it makes sense within the context of your work, it's it fits into your schema of how those things work. Research has to be easy to implement and to use, and this is a recognition that practitioners and service providers are often overloaded and there's not a lot of time to read and assimilate research. And this is the basis on which we do the work that we do within CFCA Information Exchange, is to try and find ways that are the most appropriate and the easiest ways that busy people can use research in a way that they understand and is easy for them to use. It has to be adaptable to suit the agency and practitioner needs as well. So again, what we do in CFCA is make sure that when we look at the literature around a particular area and we find what the findings have said, that we then look at the ways in which those findings, what they actually mean in practice and policy, and try to communicate that through the work that we do as well. I like this quote because I think it summarises the reality that it's no use producing world-class research if that research is not accessible for busy professionals. So one of the great debates going on at the moment is around open access to academic studies and other research, and how people are able to find those and translate them into what they're doing, and that it makes more sense for those things to be as accessible as possible rather than the current user pays system. We have to also recognise that there are organisational factors. So you might be the most enthusiastic practitioner around using research evidence that there ever was, but if you're not supported by factors within the organisation, then you'll have more trouble having the factors in place that help you to do that. So that's just a few things that we know from the literature that influences use of research within organisations. And that's leadership attitude. So there has to be a champion for it within the organisation, someone who drives the rationale and drives the meaning and the project and gets people on board to do that. And that there's a leadership response that is encouraging of using research and evidence. staff resources, of course, people have to have the time to be able to, and the skills to be able to use research in practice. If there's organisational stress or financial pressure, it's less likely to be in place. Management types, again, different management types who may be more amenable to the use of research and the reasons why it should be used. Tolerance for change within an organisation, and that there's a culture of experimentation and risk-taking. So one of the biggest risks that we have is that the push for the use of evidence-based practice and policy in some way diminishes the opportunities for people to innovate and try things out, and we don't want to lose that because that's an important part of testing, particularly in a very dynamic family environment, and responding to needs and testing out what works for families and children in this kind of setting. I just wanted to draw people's attention to, we have a paper on developing a culture of evaluation and research on our website, and these are a few of the things that talked about what organisations look like which have a culture of evaluation and research. So those organisations deliberately seek evidence in order to better design and deliver programs, and can deliver evidence to stakeholders that programs are achieving desired results and enable robust decision-making and supporting professional development. So that's the URL for that paper if people are interested. It also draws attention to a number of tools that can be used within organisations to get a sense of where the culture is at within your organisation around the use of evidence and evaluation. These slides will go up at the end of the presentation as well, so don't feel like you have to jot these down as we go. So I wanted to move on to what this looks like. That's the background to the context of how we've set up the response to the 30% requirement for evidence-based programs that exist for communities for children. So there's a number of ways that the 30% requirement can be met. One of the first ones is the online profiles that we have that are a list of evidence-based programs that have met a set of criteria that we've used to assess them as rigorous enough to be included. The way we went about that was that we looked at a number of clearinghouses and databases that are well known for their setup to host the programs that meet a certain number of criteria that recognise these programs as evidence-based. So we looked at a whole bunch of different clearinghouses and databases. One of the issues we had was that they often use different definitions of evidence, not surprisingly, and they may privilege those very scientific definitions that we talked about before. So the more rigorous that those clearinghouses and databases apply the evidence criteria, the less programs that are on those databases, which makes sense. So again, a lot of programs haven't been evaluated to the standard of a randomised controlled trial for various reasons. So we tried to get a good cross section of clearinghouses and databases that use those different definitions. We also recognise that the programs that are in these clearinghouses, their relevance to C4C programs varies. So there tended to be more parenting interventions that were in the databases and fewer community interventions. The other thing we recognise is that there might be programs out there that would be included in those clearinghouses or databases, but they haven't been submitted or they haven't been found. So we only know what we know. So one of the things that we've done is tried to put in place a system that recognises that and says there must be other programs out there that would fit those criteria, and if people know of those, then please forward them to us. That, again, is the URL of the list of evidence-based programs. I think there's 26 or 27 programs on the list. Some of them won't be a surprise to anyone, but there's details on there around the program, their target group, information on the training and so forth that's available for service providers to use. It's important to say that we recognise and increasingly recognise some of the limitations for providers in using these programs. I guess what we've tried to do is think of these programs as these are the the high-level standard programs that have a good evidence base that show that they work for families and children. So if you can run these, or if there's scope to run these, then they're one of the best choices for children and families under the circumstances that the program's been set up for. These are the criteria that we used for inclusion in the evidence-based program profiles. So just to give you some idea, and all of this information is on our website as well. So to be included in that profile database, the objectives had to be in line, of the program had to be in line with the C4C facilitating partner model. And part of that is that the programs targeted children aged 0 to 12 years and their families. We had to know that there was documented information on the program that was available. So clearly it needed to be documented and available information on aims, objectives, theoretical basis of the program logic or similar behind the program, who the target group for the program was, and the activities and documented outlined activities of that program and why they're important as well. There also needed to be a training manual or documentation available that allows for a replication in Australia. So we didn't want to provide programs that looked really good but people couldn't run them because they didn't have the material they needed to understand how to do so. We're looking for what we've called good quality evaluations with at least 20 participants in them, which we felt was a minimum to say that a minimum sample to say that the results were likely to be rigorous enough. And that the evaluation shows positive outcomes and no negative events of the negative effects of the program. So the question was, is there a reasonable assumption that the program itself changed people's knowledge, attitudes or behaviours? So that was important with these programs in particular, that it was reasonably clear that that was happening. We also wanted to know that the program had either been replicated or had a potential for replication. And again, this was so that it could be put in place in different areas and was available for C4Cs to do that. Just to stay on this for a little while, there are some things to consider. If people are looking to deliver these programs, these are the three factors to consider. The program quality is covered by the criteria. So the process we went to appoint programs to the database covered off on the program quality. So we looked, as you can see from the criteria, we looked for the things that characterise a good quality program, and that was one of the factors to consider. Program match and organisational resources are other things that need to be considered by service providers before choosing the program, and I'll just talk about them a little more. These are some of the things that are good to consider in terms of whether the program is a good match for your organisation. So how well do the goals and objectives of the particular program reflect those already of the organisation? How well do the program's goals match those of participants? So if you have very vulnerable families who have a number of risk factors, then one of the programs that's a short prevention program is not likely to be suitable. How long is the program? So again, it's not, there's a risk in putting in place a program that goes for a long period of time with families who are unable to or not keen to commit for that longer duration. And yet those programs need that longer duration of commitment to produce lasting behaviour. So again, you have to think about what suits your target group. Has the program been effective with a similar target group? So again, each program on the program profile database identifies what the target group is for that program, and I'll talk in a little while around fidelity and adaptation with those programs and whether that's one way of adapting it to suit a different target group. But often the programs are designed for a particular group, or they might be designed for general audiences. It's rare to find a program that suits all groups and situations, not surprisingly. So we encourage people when they see the program to carefully read the materials or talk to program developers around the adaptation. We've had lots of conversations with the developers of programs that are on that list, and some of them are very willing to help people to look at the ways that they may be adapted within your communities or with your target groups. So again, the details are on the website around the developers of the program to have a chat to them. And often the program may have already been adapted to a different target group, and it's worth talking to them if so. And does the program complement other programs in the organisation and the community in general? In terms of organisational resources needed to run these programs, we're very cognizant of the fact that it's not just about taking a program off the shelf and developing and delivering it. It doesn't work like that, and we recognise that. So there has to be a bunch of things that already exist or can exist within the organisation that support the development of the program. So they cut across the different areas of expertise, staff, financial support, and the time to run the program. And if these are inadequate, then the chances of success with that program are limited. So they are important important parts of delivering the evidence-based programs, and we do recognise that. So in terms of organisational resources, it's important to ask which programs have the best chance of being continued into the future. Does the program have a good chance of being integrated into the base programming of the organisation? And again, so is there the capacity, is there the commitment to do that? Can organisations collaborate with others in the community to deliver and evaluate the program? This may be one way that the resources involved in doing so, and again, it will help with the evaluation of the program and contributing to the evidence base, because there'll be larger samples to be involved in the program as well. So it's worth considering if one organisation doesn't have the expertise and the resources, whether they can partner with others within the organisation, and that will help to do that. One of the important factors around delivering the evidence-based programs is program fidelity. So basically, the definition of program fidelity is staying true to the original program design. So it's delivered in a similar setting with a similar target group, and with the same number of activities over the same duration. The higher the fidelity to the program, the greater the likelihood of positive outcomes. So it makes sense that the program, the evidence base behind the program is based on the idea that it's been evaluated for the target group that the program is targeted at. So diverting from that target group or the way that it's run means that the evidence base behind the program is compromised, so it becomes less of an evidence-based program. So fidelity is important. Again, we recognise that staying true to a program is something that service providers may need some assistance in doing, because it depends on a lot of things, or they need to recognise that these things need to be in place as well. And those sorts of things are well-trained professionals who receive the right and accredited training for the particular program, that there's a supportive infrastructure, which is one of the things we've talked about already, that there's adequate resources, managerial support, and regular process evaluations. So they're the types of evaluations that look at the way that the program is implemented and whether it's implemented correctly. The flip side of that is adaptation, and adaptation will often happen intentionally and often will happen unintentionally. And one of the ways that it does happen unintentionally is what we call a program drift. So the intention is to run the program as it exists within the program documentation, but for various reasons it doesn't work. So somewhere along the line you might lose a couple of families and decide to cut down the number of sessions or get new people in and those sorts of things. So there may be intentional decisions as well around that. And again, it's worth chatting to the program developer around which adaptations will work. So intentional changes to content, duration or delivery style may diminish the program effects. So it usually works at simpler things like changing the language to suit a different target audience or a slightly different target audience is unlikely to have an effect on the program. But changing the duration of the program or the content of the activities is one adaptation that often will change the intent of the program. So it's important to recognise that changing the program from what it is an important part of is an important consideration if you're looking to use the evidence-based programs. Down the bottom is a URL again to a couple of research briefs, I think issues 3 and 4 on that site, the briefs that are related to choosing a program and fidelity and adaptation, and they're good, easy to read and use briefs. That's not a typo. It actually, the C is missing in practice. If you try and put the C in, it sends you off to a error page. So it's not a typo. That's actually how it's spelled. The second way of meeting the 30% requirement is, again, going back to the idea that we wanted to recognise that programs that are already being delivered or that people are proposing that they would like to deliver meet 5 what we call rigorous enough criteria, and I'll get to the criteria in a minute. So these are slightly less rigorous than the ones that we used to establish the program database, but still rigorous enough for the purposes of this project. Just a note that programs must be submitted by a facilitating partner and they need to have a conversation with the grant agreement manager before submitting. If it's a community partner that wants to submit a program, they need to do this through a facilitating partner, the relevant facilitating partner, but their details can be included within the submission so that if we have questions around the program, we can go directly to the partner. Again, that's a URL for submitting programs and for further information. These are the criteria for inclusion of other programs, and again, they're just slightly less rigorous than the ones we use to establish the database. So these must be documented: a theoretical and or research background to the program, a program logic or theory of change or logic model, whatever you'd like to call it, activities in the program which generally match good practice in meeting the needs of the target group and the purpose of the program, an evaluation that's been conducted, again, with at least 20 participants, and one that has established that the program has positive benefits for the target group, and that staff members are qualified and or trained to run the program. One of the things that's come up for us already is we've had programs that have each of these things, but they don't link to each other. So we also want to look at the theoretical background has to make sense within the context of the program logic, which makes sense within the context of the the activities within the program logic make sense within the context of the research background, and that the evaluation is linked to all of those as well. So they have to have logical and coherent links between those elements. The way that the process works is that after submission of the program, CFCA researchers assess the program and provide detailed feedback to the facilitating partner. We're looking at around about 4 to 6 weeks for turnaround for those. They do take a little bit of time to get through, but we will try and get them back as soon as we can. From the assessment, there's 4 possible outcomes. The program is eligible to be included in the 30% requirement. The program is eligible to be included and it's both in the 30% requirement and the evidence-based program profiles. So it meets those additional criteria for the profiles. It's eligible for provisional approval, and I'll talk about that in a minute, or the program cannot at this stage be included in the 30% requirement. And we'll let people know when we assess it. We tick a box to say which one of these we have agreed that it is. We'll also suggest how the industry list may help with feedback. And just to give you an idea, so the industry list is a part of the broader expert panel project. The industry list is a version of the expert panel itself that is available to sector organisations to purchase assistance from. The expert panel is composed of organisations and sole traders who are highly competent in one or more of 3 areas: program planning, program implementation, and program evaluation or outcomes measurement. So the industry list is the version that's available to sector organisations. You don't have to use the industry list. You may already have relationships with existing researchers or evaluators who you wish to use, which is fine. This can be considered a resource that's at your that you can use if you wish to, but you don't have to, but it may help. And we are in the process of establishing the industry list and hope that it will be available within the next few weeks. Provisional assessment is another part of it. So again, this is in recognition that there are good programs out there, but they may not meet those rigorous assessment of other program criteria just yet, and that more time is needed to meet those criteria. So what we ask for a provisional assessment is that there's a research or theoretical background that is articulated around the program, that it does have some links. that some form of evaluation has been conducted in the past. Again, it may not meet those rigorous evaluation criteria just yet. And then we ask for people to outline the plan for meeting criteria in the online guide, the five criteria, by 30th of June 2016, so basically a year away. And that plan needs to be submitted by 30th of June this year. The plan doesn't need to be detailed. What we want to see is that you understand what the criteria are about and that you've got something in place to meet those criteria. And again, it might be that you are looking to employ some help from the industry list to help with those tasks. You might be wanting to do it in-house. But again, we'll give good feedback on the assessment sheet to let you know where we think that the work needs to be done. I just want to talk very briefly about program logic and evaluation, just so that, and this is a whistle-stop tour through these things. Program logic, again, has a number of different names. There are some differences between these, but for the purposes of this exercise, these sorts of things, we look at one particular way of doing program logic, and that's the basis of what we're looking for this project. A program logic visually represents what's going on in a program. It's basically the roadmap of the program. There are two important things that need to be included and is what makes the program logic what it is. And that's the relationship between the different parts of the program logic. So I'll show you an example in a minute, but it goes back to that idea that the research base behind the program needs to be linked to why you're targeting a particular group and then why those activities fit what the target group needs and then what the outcomes are. So there has to be logical links. It's what's called if-then relationships between the parts of the program logic. And there has to be an intention. So the program logic is a roadmap for the program itself. And again, this might change over time and probably will. So it's not that it is set in stone from the start, but that it provides a visual example of what goes on in the program. We actually have done one because we thought we better walk the walk, so we did one for the expert panel, and this is what our program logic looked like. It might not be very clear on your screens, but this is a fairly standard template for a program logic, but there's lots of different ways that they can look, and we're not really fussed about what it looks like as long as it generally has the same elements in it. So it's about what you put into your program, the inputs, what the outputs are, so what activities are done, who the participants of the program are, and then looking at what are the short-term, medium, and long-term outcomes of the project or program. Most programs won't be able to explicitly show how they impact on long-term outcomes, and we don't expect that. By the time you get to that level, you'll see just below that are the external factors, and we recognise that there are lots of different things that impact on families and parenting and those sorts of issues that have nothing to do with your program and that will influence whether long-term outcomes are achieved or not. Very hard to measure by the time you get down to that stage. But what we're looking for are evaluations that look at the short-term and possibly the medium-term outcomes for the program. And at the moment, we're working on an evaluation plan and fine-tuning that for the expert panel project that looks particularly at the medium-term outcomes for the project. And again, the other box down the bottom is assumptions. So there's certain things that need to be in place to make sure that the program's working as well that aren't necessarily in the organisation's control. I'll quickly run through the why evaluation slides. I think it's just important to provide some basis as to why we're looking at evaluation of programs being important. So these are some of the reasons why evaluation is conducted. It's conducted for quality assurance reasons, so systematically checking whether programs and services are meeting the standards of the program. Were participants satisfied with the program and did they benefit from it? And good evaluations tried to get beyond the idea of, we liked the program because the food was great or the program facilitator smiled a lot. So we're trying to find what are the nuts and bolts of why they were satisfied and what they got out of the program. And the next question is around that. So did they benefit because of the program or were there other factors that were at play? Evaluation also helps providers to know how the program can be improved or refined. So it might be that you find some parts of the program are working and some others aren't. And one of the other things we've talked about within the context of this program is what are some of the common elements of programs that key elements of programs that are the parts that work, and what are the things that are more negotiable around what works for a program? So within evaluation, you may be able to find things that can be improved or refined that are able to be adapted, and that they don't have a great impact, or they have a better impact on the program outcomes. Evaluation can also help to justify requests for further support and funding. And process evaluation will give you some idea about whether the implementation of the program was true to the program design. These are the broad types of evaluations. And one of the questions that came in quite early was around what sort of evaluation do you use at what stage? So if we're setting up a new program, what do we? How do we try to build the evidence base around that program? So it's important to say evaluation just doesn't happen at the end of a program. There's different types. Needs assessment around what's needed for the target group can happen before an initiative, or when you're reviewing a program if the needs of the target group have changed. So you're assessing and evaluating what the needs are of those particular groups that you're trying to access or help. Process and implementation evaluation basically answers the questions around, is the program implemented in the way it's intended, and is it reaching the people for whom it's designed? Outcome and impact evaluation is more likely to happen with well-established programs, and the idea is to try and figure out whether the program helped the clients and has there been any unintended outcomes. And one of the things we're very keen to capture in the expert panel more broadly is when programs work, but also when they didn't work. And why didn't they work? And it's as important to know if a particular program doesn't work with a target group as much as it is that it does. So we see that as very valuable information that we also intend to share. And there's economic evaluations as well, which talk about the benefits and costs of a program. In terms of the assessments of other programs, just one of the questions that, again, that has come up is around what sorts of evaluations are we looking for? We're certainly not expecting that people have done randomised controlled trials. In fact, the type of evaluation that's undertaken is less important than the results of the evaluation. So we'd like to see evaluations that suit the point at which the program is at, because that makes sense, but what we want to know is that the results of the evaluation are valid and that they show that a positive outcome of the program has happened. So basically, if the evaluation has an element that's pre and post-testing of participant outcomes, or there's a comparison of outcomes for those who did and didn't receive the program, or there's a comparison of two types of service interventions. And again, if we offer up a provisional assessment, this will help a lot of the programs who haven't yet had the opportunity to do an evaluation that really gives us some idea whether the program is working or not. That extra 12 months gives programs the scope to be able to do that. We also recognise that some evaluations that are put in place will go longer than that, and very happy to talk about that further. Again, there's some information at the URL at the end of that slide. So there's lots of way of collecting evaluation data. So it might be that you collect new data from key informants or clients. So I won't go into the different types of qualitative and quantitative ways of collecting data, but there is some information on our website that I will I'll show you later where that is, that looks at the different ways of doing that. It may be that you make use of internal administrative data, including program data that may already exist, that will help you look at whether the program works. Use of external administrative data as well, so that may be things like hospital data, hospital admissions, or admissions to other services that help you to look at what's going on for your clients. It may be that you use existing representative data sets to see what's happening in your area. One of the ones that's come up quite regularly already for us is that people have used the Australian Early Development Census to look at what's happening in particular demographic areas and linking them to what's happening in their programs. And there's also the longitudinal study of Australian children that's run here at the Institute of Family Studies as well. it's good to know that multiple data sources allow for the greater validity of your results and also greater depth. So ideally there'd be a few different areas to work with, but again, we recognise the limitations and probably resource limitations in doing this as well. The other important thing is that we need to balance the quantity of data with the quality of data and the ability to analyse. So it's important that we ask questions around what resources exist for people to look at that data, who's conducting the evaluation, and what are the skill sets available to you. So do you do it internally? Do you have the expertise internally? And that's often a good option because your people know the project, well. But the limitation is that that introduces a certain amount of bias into the results as well, because they're invested in the program. So you might employ someone externally, but again, them not having links to the program may be a negative. But if you don't have the internal expertise to conduct evaluations, then someone external might help. And again, the industry list will have people on there that can help. You need to know how much time you have. There's no use in collecting an enormously large amount of data but not actually having the time to analyse that data. And there are ethical issues with that as well. So collecting data from people that can't be used is not ideal if you can avoid it. Is it a one-off or an ongoing process? And I think this is a question that happens particularly for groups like playgroups that go on and don't necessarily have a start and stop point. So how do you get good figures on that? And do you need it all? So, again, going back to the idea of how much of the data do you need, and keeping that in mind at the outset in terms of your timelines and the resources available to you, and being careful to only bite off what you can chew. These are the evaluations that I mentioned before. So there's an enormous amount of information within these five evaluation resources. And these resources are particularly tailored for family support service providers. So, and they cover off on the evaluation journey. So they're worth having a look at, and they include all the sorts of things that I've discussed today, but also more broadly in terms of evaluation. So they may be useful to people. And we're hoping that we've written them in a way that is easy to use and understand for people who don't have much time to get heavily into the literature around these things. So lastly, that's the end of my presentation. I just wanted to give you the contacts for the website for Child, Family, Community Australia Information Exchange. We have a broad range of information on there which would be useful for people, particularly those who are looking at the research and the evidence behind their programs. And there's 30 years of publications and so forth on those on the website, so it's a good place to start looking for that research base. The expert panel website, that's the address to actually find information specifically on the expert panel. And lastly is the email address if you have any queries around either the industry list or the 30% requirement for communities for children as well. Please send that through, and all of us keep an eye on that through the day, and we can check out what your questions are and queries and get back to you.